Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, agreement on another bailout plan for Greece. However, negotiations continue on an Iran nuclear agreement. We'll hear about possible Russian use of the social media tool of trolling.
To either create the impression of more Putin support than there is, or to sort of muddy the waters with inflammatory accusations and conspiracy theories.
And have the Grateful Dead really seen their last show? Coming up right here on The Voice of America. After a marathon 17-hour session, members of the 19-nation Eurozone today managed to negotiate a third bailout to keep Greece in the common currency bloc. VOA's Victor Beatty joins me, and he's been following the story. Victor, what do we have on this?
Hello, Susan. Well, European Council President Donald Tusk met with reporters this morning in Brussels after an all-night session.
Today we had only one objective, to reach an agreement. After 17 hours of negotiations, we have finally reached it. Someone can say that we have an agreement. Leaders have agreed in principle that they are ready to start negotiations on an ESM program, which in other words means continued support for Greece. There are strict conditions to be met. The approval of several national parliaments, including the Greek parliament, is now needed for negotiations on an ESM program to formally begin. Nevertheless, the decision gives Greece a chance to get back on the track, with the support of European partners. It also avoids the social, economic, and political consequences that a negative outcome would have brought. I welcome the progress and the constructive position of Greece that helps to bring back trust among Eurozone partners.
Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras agreed to tough reforms in return for a three-year bailout worth about $96 billion. Greek banks have been closed for nearly 2 weeks and are nearly out of funds after the previous bailout expired June 30th, leaving the country little choice than leave the Eurozone and start printing its own currency. It was just a week ago, July 5th, when Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected previous bailout terms by the country's international lenders. Well, the new bailout plan reportedly imposes harsh conditions on Athens on labor reform, pensions, taxes, and privatization. The plan must be approved by the Greek parliament by Wednesday night before bailout talks begin. Shane Oliver, chief economist of the Sydney-based AMP Capital, told me the plan could be politically costly for the Tsipras government.
It's very uncertain as to the future of Tsipras in Greece. I kind of think that he's hoping to hang in there and maybe edge a bit more towards the centre-left rather than the extreme-left from which he's come from. But we could see emerging in Greece a more centrist party combined with elements of Syriza, the current governing party, with some of the more moderate leftist parties going forward. So it's certainly unclear as to how that politics will unfold, but I think at the end of the day, sort of the leftward lurch that the election of the Syriza government brought in, days there are probably numbered.
Shane, did the Greek government essentially agree to what the voters rejected in last week's referendum?
It is very perverse, and what you've seen in Greece is that the policy or proposal that was passed through a few days ago, passed through the Greek parliament, was actually as tough, if not tougher, than what had been rejected by Greek voters in the referendum. So it almost seemed perverse in a way. I think what has happened there effectively is that the referendum, the shutting of the banks, has sort of shown to the Greek government how bad things are getting, and therefore they've literally become desperate to get something done. So they are moving down a path which, if ultimately accepted by Greece, will end up with more austerity, tougher conditions than was originally on offer.
That's Shane Oliver, an economist in Sydney. Greek debt stands at a staggering $357 billion, about 180% of the country's annual gross domestic product. Greece has received nearly $270 billion in two previous bailouts in exchange for austerity measures that include deep spending cuts, reforms, and tax hikes. And for now, at least, avoids being the first country to exit the Eurozone since its founding in 1999.
Thank you, Victor, for details.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media about Greece. Andrew?
Well, the interesting thing on social media we're seeing just a few short hours ago is that on Twitter, it was where the deal kind of broke. We had Charles Michel, he's the Prime Minister of Belgium, and he tweeted out one word, agreement, and that was just minutes after the agreement was reached. And it's one of the first tweets to go out, from certainly from one of the European leaders, but one of the tweets, period, to go out about the deal. Shortly after he tweeted, we had Donald Tusk, the president of the EU Council, saying the Euro summit has unanimously agreed and reached an agreement. We have the Prime Minister of Luxembourg tweeting out, agreement, the day can start. So these leaders are taking to social media to make this announcement. So that's how people are getting the news firsthand. Another thing on social media we're seeing about Greece, hashtag this is a coup. Now, this hashtag started trending shortly after the deal was reached. And according to Time magazine, they trace it back to a teacher in Barcelona who tweeted, the Eurogroup proposal is a covert coup d'etat against the Greek people. Hashtag this is a coup. Hashtag Grexit. So apparently now people have seized on this, saying that the deal is bad for Greece. It's become the top trending topic in France, Germany. Certainly Greece is showing a lot of interest in it as well. People seizing on this and saying that it's not a great deal for Greece and it's going to have ramifications. So that's been playing out in social media as well.
Well, I guess we probably knew we were going to hear both sides of this one.
Exactly. And this is the side now. They're coming at full force. And some of the things that they're tweeting out, it's fascinating. They're taking the EU flag and superimposing Nazi symbolism over it, saying that Germany driving this deal is trying to take over Greece. So people have very, very strong feelings about this
across social media. A lot of anger about it, I guess. A lot of anger out there about
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew, for stopping by.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Technological advances have allowed genetic scientists to conduct research in a matter of hours that at one time may have taken days or months. Genetic researchers are making significant progress in tracking down causes of major diseases and conditions, which will lead to improved diagnosis and treatments. Unfortunately, since many researchers don't have ready access to the kind of computing systems that can process tremendous amounts of data, important advancements in genetic research can be hindered. Scientists from the University of Missouri have introduced a free online service that could help provide the kind of data processing needed by these researchers. Called RNA Miner, the new computing service could help scientists obtain faster results in plant and animal genomic research. A typical data analysis request may be finished in several hours by RNA Miner, and the service is free. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The foreign minister and his counterparts from the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany continue to work to finalize a long-sought comprehensive agreement on Iran's nuclear program. VOA's Heather Murdoch is there in Vienna, waiting and waiting and waiting, and she joins us on the line. Hi, Heather.
Hi there.
What do we know so far?
Well, we don't know much so far. Everything we've also heard the opposite is true. We've heard there's going to be a deal today. We've heard there's not going to be a deal today. One indicator we got was that Iranian President Rouhani was expected to speak at 7:30 tonight, making us think that there must be a deal before then. But then we saw something else on Twitter saying there was going to be no speech.
So what are the sticking points?
The two major sticking points that people have been talking about have been the timing of sanctions relief and military sites. Iran wants the sanctions lifted as quickly as possible, and besides various countries that don't want to lift sanctions and people in those countries, is also the issue of the legal framework of the sanctions is going to take a long time to unwind. The other issue is that Iran has, as far as we know at this point, will not agree to allow all of their military sites to be inspected. And in fact, no country that's not actually occupied after a war really would. But the other world powers need enough access to those sites in order to check to see if Iran is working towards building a nuclear weapon.
After all this time, day after day after day, are there still signs that the negotiators might just throw up their hands and go home?
Well, they have, especially the Secretary of State, John Kerry, has actually said that many times. Just a couple of days ago, he was saying, you know, we still have tough issues to work out, and we will walk away from this deal if it's not a good deal. The Iranians are less likely to say it. They are constantly saying that we will make a deal, just be patient.
Well, I know you've been very patient waiting there all this time. I hope your waiting ends soon. Thank you, Heather, for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, using trolling as a propaganda tool. And are the Grateful Dead actually dead to concert goers? A secretive Russian program designed to flood the internet with pro-Kremlin and anti-U.S. comments and posts has been brought into the public eye as a result of a lawsuit brought by a former employee. The agency is what's commonly referred to as a troll factory, and until now, its very existence has routinely been denied by the Kremlin. International Edition's Doug Bernard follows cyber issues and joins me now. Hi, Doug.
Great to see you, Susan.
Oh, it's always nice to have you come by the studio. But explain to us, what is a troll factory?
Well, in internet lingo, trolling is the act of leaving blog posts or especially comments on news stories and other sites that are intentionally inflammatory and that are designed specifically to rile people up, get them angry, and turn what might have been a sensible discussion into, you know, it just devolves into name-calling and whatnot. It's designed to muddy the waters. And so what appears here is that what has come to light is an agency. It's called the Agency for Internet Studies, curious title, that employs hundreds of people whose job is specifically to go out and troll on these websites.
And what did the lawsuit allege, and what came to light because of it?
So it was brought by Ludmila Savchuk. She's in her 30s. She worked at this AIS agency in St. Petersburg for several months. She alleged that she wasn't getting paid enough and that she was working longer than she really should have by labor laws. But really what came to light is how this place works.
This came out in the courtroom.
This came out in the courtroom. Now, the Kremlin has routinely denied that any such thing happens. But here we see an example. Ludmila spells out in her lawsuit where employees were created false IDs, went and were expected to leave, you know, 100, 150 comments on various websites every day, basically to accuse the U.S. of being warmongers or support Putin or
propaganda.
Absolutely. Designed to either create the impression of more Putin support than there is, or to sort of muddy the waters with inflammatory accusations and conspiracy theories.
Do we know specifically who is in charge of it or funding it? Do we know for sure?
No, we really don't. Now, technically, AIS is run by Mikhail Bystrov. He's a retired police colonel. However, we've learned that AIS is actually financed through a holding company run by Yevgeny Pigzorin. Now, people may not know who that is. Technically,
no.
He's Vladimir Putin's personal chef.
Wow.
But he also, as the head of several holding companies, which millions of rubles pass through. And in fact, he was recently tied to another media scandal, which was designed, apparently, a conspiracy to plant false information in different Russian newspapers.
Do you think maybe that other countries are doing this as well?
No doubt. But I think what's interesting here is there's a clear link between the government and these kinds of activities. I think many more times, especially in China, people are paid by the government to censor and to take things down from the internet. And I think in some countries, various, you know, de facto, you know, patriotic groups might go out there and campaign for their country. But I don't think, you know, you really see governments actively supporting, you know, these kind of online propaganda efforts.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug. That's a very interesting story, and folks can read it on our website, right?
Yes, they can.
VOAnews.com.
And they're free to leave their comments there as well.
Great. Thanks a lot, Doug.
You bet.
You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame group, the Grateful Dead, played their final three shows at Chicago's Soldier Field this month. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA's Ray McDonald talked about the concerts and whether they were actually the Dead's last concerts.
Ray, this was really something. These were 3 days in a row and three shows in a row and three sellouts, right?
Three sold-out shows at Soldier Field in Chicago. And it was no accident the Dead played their final shows there, because it was at Soldier Field in July 1995 when guitarist Jerry Garcia gave his final concert. He died 1 month later.
Now, these shows featured some of their greatest hits. It featured some of their songs that people might not have heard in a while, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dead really went back to their early psychedelic days for a few of their numbers. I mean, this was the Dead playing for its core constituency, the longtime Deadheads, the people who had been with them maybe right from the very beginning in the 1960s. So they got pretty adventurous, and then they played some of their better-known hits as well.
Trucking. Got my chips cashed in. Keep trucking like the two-dog man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on, on.
Now, the thing about the people called the Deadheads, they will have bootlegs of concerts that they've been to. Sometimes they're very devoted followers. They go from show to show to show to show to show, but that's all come to an end now.
Supposedly it's come to an end. And one thing I should say about the Deadheads is that decades before the internet existed, these people were trading information about the band. The Grateful Dead was really the first act, first big rock act I can think of, to create its own culture. And these people would travel around the country to be with them. Now, as to whether these were the final shows, that's an open question. When all is said and done, these shows may rack up more than $55 million. They set an online live event streaming record with more than 175,000 pay-per-view streams purchased. Their drummer, Bill Kreutzmann, has already said that he would like to do some East Coast shows with the so-called Core Four members. So it might be their last, and then again, it might not. The average age of the Core Four is 70. That may be working against them.
That could work against them. Of course, the Rolling Stones and the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers.
Paul McCartney, you can name exceptions.
They're all of that same generation, pretty much, and they are doing tours now. So, and the Stones, I understand, are selling out. So.
Oh, yeah.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You know, if you have any questions or comments, you can send a tweet to VOA_music. That'll get to all of our music folks. And you can send one to VOA_IE if you want to direct it to me or anybody here on the show. Also, you can listen for Ray to count down the top 20 songs of the week and the top 5 songs of the week by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
From the world of sports, Serbia's Novak Djokovic, the world number one men's tennis player, won his third Wimbledon title in the past 5 years Sunday in London. The 28-year-old Djokovic defeated Switzerland's Roger Federer in the championship for the second straight year. Park Brewer is our sportsman.
You know, it was great to see him once again face off against Switzerland's Roger Federer. They played last year in a great final that went five sets. This time it went four sets. Again, very closely fought. The first two were tiebreakers in which Djokovic won the first one 7-6, and then Federer came back to win the next one 6-7. That one in the tiebreaker point went 12 points to 10. That's a long one. But then, of course, Djokovic closed him out 6-4, 6-3. Federer just continues to amaze me. This is a guy that is age 33 years old, still playing at the top of his game. He's won all these Grand Slam tournaments in his career. Could have called it quits, just keeps going. It's amazing. But Djokovic knew, you know, back when Federer was winning all these titles and Rafael Nadal of Spain as well, that he had to lift his game to be able to compete. And he's done so and just playing great tennis right now.
Thanks, Park, for your insight. We would like to invite our listeners to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Brazil have a long history of strong bilateral relations. The two countries hold similar views and goals on many issues. So, for example, both countries are committed to expanding inclusive economic growth and prosperity, promoting international peace and security and respect for human rights, and helping people in need, not just in the United States and Brazil, but globally. This is particularly true of countries that face chronic hunger, such as Mozambique. Mozambique needs help. 2 decades ago, the country emerged from 16 years of civil war that left it in shambles, and the 20 years of stability and peace since then have seen significant strides forward, including impressive economic growth. Nonetheless, Mozambique is prone to natural disasters such as droughts and floods, which damage the agricultural sector and the country's overall economy. That is one reason why much of the rural population is impoverished, and as much as 64% of Mozambicans are food insecure. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the University of Florida and Michigan State University, and the Brazilian Cooperation Agency, or ABC, and other Brazilian government agencies have partnered with the government of Mozambique to work on reducing poverty, hunger, and malnutrition as part of Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. The idea is to help strengthen the country's capacity to produce more high-quality and nutritious foods, like vegetables, oilseeds, and grain legumes. The partnership works with family and subsistence farmers to help them increase their yields and then enable them to bring their product to the market. The program strengthened the capacity of Mozambique's Agricultural Research Institute in research administration, seed production, and land use planning. It also worked to improve communication and extension information dissemination, including training and support to extension technicians. Experts from Brazil and the U.S. partners cooperated closely with Mozambican counterparts in making these gains. Farmers were also trained in new crop management practices, such as more environmentally sensitive irrigation technologies. They also learned how to plant better and more disease-resistant crop varieties and improve post-harvest handling in ways that reduced losses and increased incomes. On June 30th, during a meeting with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, President Barack Obama announced an additional $2 million for expanding the USAID and ABC partnership to help Mozambique attain food security for all. No one should have to go to bed hungry. That is the goal to which all of us should aspire. The United States and Brazil are working to reach it, one country at a time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.